chapters are the field notes covering the events that culminated in my stopping the world. In summing up, I can say that when I began the apprenticeship, there was another reality. That is to say, there was a sorcery description of the world, which I didn't know. Don Juan, as a sorcerer and a teacher, taught me that description. The 10-year apprenticeship I've undergone consisted, therefore, in setting up that unknown reality by unfolding its description, adding increasingly more complex parts as I went along. The termination of the apprenticeship meant that I had learned a new description of the world in a convincing and authentic manner, and thus I'd become capable of eliciting a new perception of the world, which matched its new description. In other words, I had gained membership. Don Juan stated that in order to arrive at seeing, one first had to stop the world. Stopping the world was indeed an appropriate rendition of certain states of awareness in which the reality of everyday life is altered because the flow of interpretation, which ordinarily runs uninterruptedly, has been stopped by a set of circumstances alien to that flow. In my case, the set of circumstances alien to my normal flow of interpretations was the sorcery description of the world. Don Juan's precondition for stopping the world was that one had to be convinced. In other words, one had to learn the new description in a total sense, for the purpose of pitting it against the old one, and in that way break the dogmatic certainty which we all share that the validity of our perceptions or our reality of the world is not to be questioned. After stopping the world, the next step was seeing. By that, Don Juan meant what I would like to categorize as responding to the perceptual solicitations of a world outside the description we have learned to call reality. My contention is that all these steps can only be understood in terms of the description to which they belong, and since it was a description that he endeavored to give me from the beginning, I must then let his teachings be the only source of entrance into it. Thus, I have left Don Juan's words to speak for themselves. Carlos Castaneda, 1972. Journey to Istlan, The Lessons of Don Juan. Part 1. Stopping the World. 1. Reaffirmations from the world around us. I understand you know a great deal about plants, sir, I said to the old Indian in front of me. A friend of mine had just put us in contact and left the room, and we had introduced ourselves to each other. The old man had told me that his name was Juan Matus. Did your friend tell you that? He asked casually. Yes, he did. I pick plants. Or rather, they let me pick them, he said softly. We were in the waiting room of a bus depot in Arizona. I asked him in very formal Spanish if he would allow me to question him. I said, would the gentleman, caballero, permit me to ask some questions? Caballero, which is derived from the word caballo, or horse, originally meant horseman or a nobleman on horseback. He looked at me inquisitively. I'm a horseman without a horse, he said with a big smile. And then he added, I've told you that my name is Juan Matus. I liked his smile. I thought that, obviously, he was a man that could appreciate directness, and I decided to boldly tackle him with a request. I told him I was interested in collecting and studying medicinal plants. I said that my special interest was the uses of the hallucinogenic cactus, peyote, which I had studied at length at the university in Los Angeles. I thought that my presentation was very serious. I was very contained, and sounded perfectly credible to myself. The old man shook his head slowly, and I, encouraged by his silence, added that it would no doubt be profitable for us to get together and talk about peyote. It was at that moment that he lifted his head and looked me squarely in the eyes. It was a formidable look, yet it wasn't menacing or awesome in any way. It was a look that went through me. I became tongue-tied at once and couldn't continue with the harangues about myself. That was the end of our meeting. Yet he left on a note of hope. He said that perhaps I could visit him at his house someday. It would be difficult to assess the impact of Don Juan's look if my inventory of experience is not somehow brought to bear on the uniqueness of that event. When I began to study anthropology and thus met Don Juan, I was already an expert in getting around. I'd left my home years before, and that meant in my evaluation that I was capable of taking care of myself. Whenever I was rebuffed, I could usually cajole my way in or make concessions, argue, get angry, or, if nothing succeeded, I would whine or complain. In other words, there was always something I knew I could do under the circumstances. And never in my life had any human being stopped my momentum so swiftly and so definitely as Don Juan did that afternoon. But it wasn't only a matter of being silenced. There had been times when I'd been unable to say a word to my opponent because of some inherent respect I felt for him. Still, my anger or frustration was manifested in my thoughts. Don Juan's look, however, numbed me to the point that I couldn't think coherently. I became thoroughly intrigued with that stupendous look and decided to search for him. I prepared myself for 6 months after that first meeting, reading up on the uses of peyote among the American Indians, especially about the peyote cult of the Indians of the Plains. I became acquainted with every work available, and when I felt I was ready, I went back to Arizona. Saturday, December 17th, 1960. I found his house after making long and taxing inquiries among the local Indians. It was early afternoon when I arrived and parked in front of it. I saw him sitting on a wooden milk crate. He seemed to recognize me and greeted me as I got out of my car. We exchanged social courtesies for a while, and then, in plain terms, I confessed that I'd been very devious with him the first time we'd met. I'd boasted that I knew a great deal about peyote, when in reality I knew nothing about it. He stared at me. His eyes were very kind. I told him that for 6 months I'd been reading to prepare myself for our meeting, and that this time I really knew a great deal more. He laughed. Obviously, there was something in my statement which was funny to him. He was laughing at me, and I felt a bit confused and offended. He apparently noticed my discomfort and assured me that, although I had had good intentions, there was really no way to prepare myself for our meeting. I wondered if it would have been proper to ask whether that statement had any hidden meaning, but I didn't. Yet he seemed to be attuned to my feelings, and proceeded to explain what he had meant. He said that my endeavors reminded him of a story about some people a certain king had persecuted and killed once upon a time. He said that in the story, the persecuted people were indistinguishable from their persecutors, except that they insisted on pronouncing certain words in a peculiar manner proper only to them. That flaw, of course, was the giveaway. The king posted roadblocks at critical points where an official would ask every man passing by to pronounce a key word. Those who could pronounce it the way the king pronounced it would live, but those who couldn't were immediately put to death. The point of the story was that one day a young man decided to prepare himself for passing the roadblock by learning to pronounce the test word just as the king liked it. Don Juan said, with a broad smile, that in fact, It took the young man 6 months to master such a pronunciation. And then came the day of the great test. The young man very confidently came upon the roadblock and waited for the official to ask him to pronounce the word. At that point, Don Juan very dramatically stopped his recounting and looked at me. His pause was very studied and seemed a bit corny to me, but I played along. I'd heard the theme of the story before. It had to do with Jews in Germany and the way one could tell who was a Jew by the way they pronounced certain words. I also knew the punchline. The young man was going to get caught because the official had forgotten the key word and asked him to pronounce another word, which was very similar, but which the young man had not learned to say correctly. Don Juan seemed to be waiting for me to ask what happened, so I did. "What happened to him?" I asked, trying to sound naive and interested in the story. "The young man, who was truly foxy," he said, "realized that the official had forgotten the key word, and before the man could say anything else, he confessed that he had prepared himself for 6 months." He made another pause and looked at me with a mischievous glint in his eyes. This time, he had turned the tables on me. The young man's confession was a new element, and I no longer knew how the story would end. "Well, what happened then?" I asked, truly interested. "The young man was killed instantly, of course," he said, and broke into a roaring laughter. I liked very much the way he'd entrapped my interest. Above all, I liked the way he'd linked that story to my own case. In fact, he seemed to have constructed it to fit me. He was making fun of me in a very subtle and artistic manner. I laughed with him. Afterwards, I told him that no matter how stupid I sounded, I was really interested in learning something about plants. "I like to walk a great deal," he said. I thought he was deliberately changing the topic of conversation to avoid answering me. I didn't want to antagonize him with my insistence. He asked me if I wanted to go with him on a short hike in the desert. I eagerly told him that I would love to walk in the desert. "This is no picnic," he said, in a tone of warning. I told him that I wanted very seriously to work with him. I said that I needed information, any kind of information, on the uses of medicinal herbs, and that I was willing to pay him for his time and effort. "You'll be working for me," I said, "and I'll pay you wages." "How much would you pay me?" he asked. I detected a note of greed in his voice. "Whatever you think is appropriate," I said. "Pay me for my time with your time," he said. I thought he was a most peculiar fellow. I told him I didn't understand what he meant. He replied that there was nothing to say about plants. Thus, to take my money would be unthinkable for him. He looked at me piercingly. "What are you doing in your pocket?" he asked, frowning. "Are you playing with your wanger?" He was referring to my taking notes on a minute pad inside the enormous pockets of my windbreaker. When I told him what I was doing, he laughed heartily. I said that I didn't want to disturb him by writing in front of him. "If you want to write, write," he said. "You don't disturb me." We hiked in the surrounding desert until it was almost dark. He didn't show me any plants, nor did he talk about them at all. We stopped for a moment to rest by some large bushes. "Plants are very peculiar things," he said, without looking at me. "They are alive, and they feel." At the very moment he made that statement, a strong gust of wind shook the desert chaparral around us. The bushes made a rattling noise. "Do you hear that?" he asked me, putting his right hand to his ear as if he were aiding his hearing. "The leaves and the wind are agreeing with me." I laughed. The friend who had put us in contact had already told me to watch out because the old man was very eccentric. I thought the agreement with the leaves was one of his